Welcome, everyone, to episode 88 of Underserved. Joining me today is Jason Oberg, co-founder and CTO at Sycuity. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Jason, thank you so much for joining me today on Underserved.
Thanks for having me, Andrew. Looking forward to chatting today.
So I believe you're the first guest that grew up in Hawaii. What was that like getting an introduction to technology?
Unconventional, I'd say. You know, so obviously we're very far from the heart of Silicon Valley and the core of technology. A lot of people surf, love to fish, a lot of hunting, a lot of outdoor stuff. But I always grew up with around a computer. You know, I'm a millennial, so I was kind of growing up when the internet became a thing and became a big part of our lives. Maybe not my entire life, we always had a computer, but, you know, a lot of my childhood. And I remember getting, when we first got the internet, I was always on it, you know, always playing video games. And it was just something good to do when you got bored of being on an island all the time. So
it's hard to imagine getting bored there, but you got into an online gaming community?
I did, yes. So there was a group of friends that I had that we would play various different games. I played a game called Age of Empires, played Warcraft 3 a lot. These are kind of games where you call real-time strategy games where you build cities and attack other people and so on. It was fun. I mean, I know that, you know, I talk to people nowadays and they say, oh, well, you know, why did you leave Hawaii? But, you know, Hawaii is obviously beautiful. It's an amazing place in terms of opportunity to, I would say, grow, to learn a lot more about technology, these type of things. It's not the Mecca for that. And when you actually grow up there, you see the same people every day. It's a very small community, right? So I think folks that have lived in and grew up in small towns can relate because it's very similar. You feel a little isolated. And then, you know, you're obviously on an island, so you can't just, you know, on a whim, drive to the neighboring city. You're kind of stuck there. So
Luke Skywalker syndrome.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's a good way of putting it.
Now, were your parents involved in tech at all in their careers?
No, not really. So my mom was a professional surfer. That's how actually they ended up in Hawaii. My dad is a huge surfer as well. They both went to Hawaii to, you know, it's some of the best surfing, obviously, on the planet. It's very consistent because it's an island. And depending on the time of year, there's swell on every side of the island. So you could pretty much surf all year round and the temperatures are pretty much always the same. So it's obviously ideal for that. So my dad was a CPA. Eventually, once he, you know, realized he should stop just surfing every day and get a job. You know, he was always a little into computers because obviously, you know, accounting is all on, you know, computers on a daily basis, at least as things, you know, became more connected and so on. And so I think he always had a computer at home for that reason. And I think that just helped me kind of get exposed to it. But he definitely wasn't a techie. I think he was always interested in computers. Like he always liked getting a new one, but he wasn't an engineer or anything of that nature.
Now, was mom like traveling the world to like surf competitions and stuff and training at home? Like, what was that like?
Yeah. So by the time I was born, that was all fizzling off. It's actually pretty amazing. So she had won, I think, a total of 7 world titles. The last two, wow, she won actually after she had my brother, I believe. She won a world title, had my brother, and then actually won another one. And then I think from there pretty much stopped. And so I was, you know, obviously was born after that. But she did start a really famous surf school in Hawaii. She taught it. She ran that for over 20 years or so. But yeah, so I miss the world traveling. But with my dad prior to my brother and I mean, they've surfed all over the world. I have a funny story. My dad was telling me, you know, he was surfing out in Morocco on a trip with my mom. And my dad saw this wave like way out in the middle of the ocean and starts paddling out there. And he's like, it's, you know, the surf's really big and all these, you know, people in fishing boats were like trying to rescue him because they've never seen a surfer out there. Like, what are you doing out here? They definitely traveled all over the place. It's pretty amazing. I always tell them they should write a book.
He's like, I'm from Hawaii. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, the Moroccans were like, this guy's crazy. What's he doing out here?
So in high school, like, do you get any exposure to computers at all?
A little bit. So we had, I tried to take as many courses that we have. And we didn't have any software programming classes. I didn't get exposed to that at all in high school. We had kind of like general business, you know, general computer business class, like learn how to use Excel and Microsoft Word. And there's also a, you know, typing class, which is actually good. I can type extremely fast, like 110 words a minute. And I think that's actually part of it is because I took some of those classes when I was younger. So really not very much. I mean, we had a computer lab. I remember in eighth grade, we had a really nice computer lab. In Hawaii, it's really hot too. So it's really nice going to a computer lab because it's all air conditioned, and air conditioned is always a treat in Hawaii. It's very hard to find. So I remember we would go into this teacher's computer lab before school. I'd get there at 6:30 in the morning, and he would let us all play Counter-Strike on, it was all a LAN environment. So it was, back then the internet, we were running on 56K dial-up modems, and online gameplay is pretty slow. And so we would go on, he'd let us in there, and we'd go and actually play, and very high bandwidth LAN, connection. That was always super fun. So I had kind of a lot of exposure through these certain teachers that had computer labs that let us go in there in some of these classes. But other than that, it was kind of all me just fiddling around at home and this kind of stuff.
So you decide to go to school in the mainland.
Mm-hmm.
What drew you to UCSB?
My mom actually grew up in Santa Barbara, so I had some family there, so I was familiar with the area. So my grandma was there, her sister, my aunt. It's funny, Santa Barbara is one of those places that a lot of people from Hawaii end up, I think, because it's, it's a little bit bigger, but it still feels like a small town. It's still kind of beachy feeling, so it's an easy transition from Hawaii. I knew some folks that were already there, a lot of good things, and UC Santa Barbara has an amazing engineering school. It was a good opportunity for me to go somewhere that wouldn't be, like going to the East Coast for me, which I think would have been bad for me. And so it was an easy transition from culturally from Hawaii, I would say. And then, it's obviously a great engineering school.
So you decide to go into computer engineering. What are you studying there?
Yeah, so I was really excited about that. I mean, I remember when I was applying, as selected that major and I got in, there was so much I didn't know about, computers. I had, had basically my exposure of fiddling around and playing games and so on. So I was really, really excited about it. Obviously in lower division for computer engineering, you kind of take a lot of the general classes, Java, C programming, and then some very basic kind of more circuits classes. As things evolved, I started to get a lot more interested in I'd say where the hardware and software kind of intersect. People use the term embedded systems and so on. So I was doing a lot more low-level software programming, some chip design work, building kind of systems and so on. That's really where I found my niche, I'd say. I really liked that domain because you get a lot of exposure to how our computer's really, really running. If you are building pure software, you're abstracting away what all the hardware is doing. So you kind of lose touch of that. And then if you're doing pure circuit design or transistor layouts and more analog design, you have really loose perspective about what the actual software is doing and how the system works. So being in the middle, I kind of was able to skirt both edges, which I really liked.
Then you started doing some undergrad research there as well?
I did, yes. Yeah. It's kind of funny. It's, when I started, I never thought I would go down that path, sort of by accident. So, UC Santa Barbara is somewhat isolated. I mean, it's within Santa Barbara, but there's not a lot of big tech companies nearby, right? It's not like being in Silicon Valley or anything like that. And so I was, summer after my sophomore year, I was looking for an internship. Some of my friends had left for the summer for an internship, and I was kind of, sitting around saying, I'd like to do something. And so I ended up getting an idea of just emailing some professors and that were in my interest area, like this embedded systems kind of space, and trying to see if they had any research projects and things that we could work on. And that's when I got in touch with Ryan Kastner, who ended up becoming my PhD advisor, to see if there's any undergraduate research I could help with, just basically like an intern type thing for some of his grad students. And that ended up working out really well. I ended up working with one of his grad students on this underwater modem project. So, communicating underwater, you have to use sound. You can't use any sort of a EM type, transmissions like you do in the air, with Wi-Fi or anything else. And so they built these underwater sensor networks that would basically collect data about what's going on in the ocean and so on. And then they would communicate that back to these different sensor nodes that were kind of sprinkled all around the ocean. And so I helped on some of the algorithms and analysis of the data that they were doing after the fact, just supporting one of the grad students. So it's pretty cool to get exposed to that because it's something that you wouldn't even you'd have no exposure to that normally with, with your undergraduate coursework and so on.
So RF won't propagate underwater. So they decide to use sound modems instead.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, because of water, you have a lot of light refraction and you have to use sound underwater basically. So it's kind of interesting. I mean, that's why obviously submarines, they use the sound and they have to go to the surface to transmit actual data, this kind of stuff. So it's kind of interesting, right? So if you want to communicate underwater, you have to use sound. So they built a whole underwater modem that was using sound for this.
Now, do they try to avoid messing with the whales or anyone else that's using sound?
it's funny. She, the grad student I worked with. I think she did some work with Scripps Research Institute at UC San Diego after she left UC Santa Barbara. And they have a huge, obviously, marine biology thing. And so I think that was a common question that was asked. But it was determined that it did not mess with the whales. So I don't think it was high enough power or frequency yet. So.
Green check mark.
Yeah.
So after that, you move into some computer vision activity as well?
So summer after my junior year of undergraduate, Ryan Kastner actually left UC Santa Barbara and became a professor at UC San Diego. He brought all of his grad students with him. You know, I just hinted at this prior grad student, she, you know, working with Scripps. That's why she was down there. So after my junior year, I, you know, liked what I was doing. So I said, hey, you know, can I come down and continue to work with your students on some research activity? And I had actually some family in San Diego. My dad's side of the family is actually from San Diego. So it was easy for me because I was able to stay with one of my aunts down there. Basically, it was a face detection algorithm. So basically an algorithm, computer vision algorithm that uses machine learning, or it's basically inference to figure out if an image has a human face in it. And so what we did was we actually took that and built it all in hardware. So one of his postdocs built the entire thing in hardware. I did a lot of testing and evaluation of that. He had a C program version of it and the hardware version, and I helped him kind of compare results between those two and so on. It was a great experience. We actually got a paper published. You know, getting a paper published as an undergraduate, it's always a key milestone, because if you do that, you can pretty much, I wouldn't say guarantee yourself to get into a good PhD program, but it's highly likely. So that was really, really valuable for me. I learned a lot through that experience, just about, you know, how to build like a real functioning system and so on. So, and obviously it was a good exposure to more computer vision type of applications.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Syrinx, the developer-founded, developer-run software consulting company. For more information, visit syrinx.com. That's syrinx.com.
Now, when you go to grad school down at UCSD, you also get introduced to the National Science Foundation.
Yeah. You know, where the kind of NSF stuff met up was, you know, my last year of undergraduate at Santa Barbara, I started getting into a lot of hardware security work, working with Tim Sherwood, who's still a professor there. From there, I really liked hardware security. I thought it was a really interesting topic area. Obviously knew Ryan very well. I ended up, after that computer vision experience working with him the summer after my junior year, I thought, you know, I should go for this whole PhD thing. It seems pretty cool. I've been enjoying this research and working with Ryan. And so I ended up applying to the PhD program at UCSD and getting in with the focus on, you know, getting a PhD on computer science focused on hardware security specifically. Through that, I actually ended up applying for a National Science Foundation graduate research fellowship, which I was able to get, which is great because it basically funds, the grad students in computer science are very often paid, but typically they're paid from research funding from the professor. But the NSF fellowship basically pays me from NSF directly, as well as covers all of my other, you know, tuition and other expenses too. So basically free labor for Ryan, which is great for him. But then the NSF stipend is actually, I think, was slightly higher than the normal graduate research stipend. So that was obviously great. You know, grad students make a lot of money, so any increase helps, right? I felt honored to receive that. That was a, you know, great thing to get from NSF. NSF's a great organization.
Then you did a internship for Qualcomm around that time too?
Yeah, so I you kind of see this trend where in undergrad I was kind of saying, okay, do I like this research thing? I concluded, yeah, I do like this. I wanted to really take more of an industry, so I want to say conventional industry internship. You know, a lot of my friends had done that. I hadn't worked at a big company. I wanted to try it out. So yeah, I worked at Qualcomm for a summer working on some performance modeling of some of the chips that they were building, supporting one of the engineers there. Qualcomm's obviously a great company. They build tons of amazing devices, and you know, they're leader in mobile. But the specific role I had, it wasn't for me. It kind of was an eye opener for me of, you know, I don't think I could show up every day and sit in this office and incrementally turn this crank. You know, I remember vividly there was a project I was given that said, okay, do this thing. It's gonna take you a week. My mentor slash, you know, manager at that time, you know, expected me to take me longer, and I did it in 3 hours or something. And then I went back to him and said, hey, I'm done. Here it is. Here's the output. Like, what do you want me to do now? And he's like, just go figure something out. So I mean, that I was just kind of, you know, I was like, I don't know if I can work at this pace, maybe someday in my life. But like I said, it has nothing to do with the company itself. I think Qualcomm's an amazing company, but it was just an eye opener for the type of role. So,
yeah, I mean, a lot of internships and co-ops, like, you know, you end up getting your work done quickly and you have time to learn or explore or whatever. And mm-hmm. you know, you get a taste of the company and figure out, like, would I want to be here long term? Like, my co-op at UMass, like, great company. I just couldn't really picture myself there. And sometimes you learn what's not a good fit, you know, as part of the co-op or internship. And that can be as instructive as finding, like, the perfect place where, you know, you end up getting a job after you graduate.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what do you end up doing after that?
So I kept working on a lot of the hardware security stuff with Ryan and Tim. Not to jump too far ahead, but that ended up, obviously, we ended up founding a company that it leveraged a lot of this technology. During my normal year, I was taking courses on general computer science courses. I think the one learning I had through grad school, though, was that I didn't really want to work in pure circuits. It's like low-level circuit design. And so when I actually started my PhD at UC San Diego, I was a computer engineering major. The subtlety there was simply that I had to take a certain set of more low-level hardware design courses like VLSI, which is, you know, how, you know, CMOS transistors and things of that nature. I ended up finishing my master's with a computer engineering degree, but realized right around that time that some of the coursework I would have to take for the PhD in computer engineering, I just wasn't interested in at all. I got a lot more interested in more theoretical computer science. I got interested in cryptography. I wouldn't have been able to really take those courses, or I could have as an extracurricular thing, but I wanted to focus on research. So I really changed my major to focus on some of those things, which, you know, I had to basically switch from computer engineering to computer science, which probably most listeners here are kind of like, well, that's kind of the same thing. But the really shift for me mentally was, you know, getting away from like the pure chip hardware design type of expertise into a little bit more of the security kind of theoretical aspects of it, which were a lot more interesting to me. So that was kind of a learning I had in grad school. It's still a very interesting area for me today.
You got another stint in a large company as a research intern at Microsoft?
Yeah. It's funny. So I was like, you know, obviously talking a lot about security just a moment ago when I interned at Microsoft Research, probably the summer after my junior year, or my third year, excuse me, of graduate school. And that was on a completely different topic from security, but it's still really, really interesting. So Microsoft Research is unique in that it's one of the few places within large companies that let you do pure research. There's other, you know, groups, like, for example, Intel Labs has this, and some big companies have, you know, Google has their X initiative where you can do pure research. But most companies don't want to, you know, most commercial companies don't want to invest in things that may not go anywhere because, you know, obviously impacts your P&L and so on and so forth. So, but Microsoft was unique in that. And so I actually worked for a summer in Redmond working on computer vision type applications again. It was actually sort of similar to what I had done after my junior year in undergraduate with Ryan. But we basically took the Microsoft Xbox Kinect, which is, you know, a device that tracks your body parts and you can play games and, you know, play volleyball with your friends and so on and so forth. We actually took that algorithm that was detecting the body parts. So it would tell you, you know, this is your hand or this is your face or whatever, and built that in completely in hardware. So it was a pure software application running on the Kinect. And the general premise is that when you run something in hardware, you could typically get it to run a lot faster. The product teams at that time were under the impression that, you know, it would be hard to build this in hardware because of the way the algorithm is structured. It's basically very simple from a computation standpoint. It's a decision tree, but every node of that decision tree, you have to actually like look up a lot of data. So it's very memory intensive. There's not a lot of compute. FPGAs are really good at like streaming data in and computing. But if you have to do a lot of data access, you're basically spending all your time going to memory and you lose all the benefit that you'd get from computing. And so the team at Microsoft kind of figured out a way of really efficiently communicating with external memory. And we're able to build a really cool system that actually would stream out data really effectively from memory and be able to really maintain a lot of the performance. So we built a whole kind of prototype system of it. And it was really cool. We actually had it all working. You could actually like, you know, move around and see the, you know, the images come up. It was all simulated. So it was, you know, obviously slow, but it was functioning hardware. It was just a matter of, you know, productizing it. So that was a great experience. We ended up patenting that. So I have a patent on that algorithm that we built. We published a paper at a conference in an FPGA conference, which is a reprogrammable chip conference in Norway. So I got to go out there. Microsoft paid for my trip to Norway. So that was pretty cool.
I am altering the scope of the project. Pray I don't alter it any further.
Excellent. Let the scope creep flow. Keep adding features.
To deploy the release, deliver first, you must.
I find your lack of faith in change management disturbing.
Missing your deadline is the path to the dark side.
If you or someone you know manages software development projects, we can help. Call the offices of Syrinx Consulting. Syrinx provides software consultants who hit the ground running to help you deliver right away. Our toll-free number is 888-579-7469, option 1. Or you can live chat with Berg at Syrinx.com. That's Syrinx.com.
Syrinx is not a law office and this is not legal advice. Offer valid only in the United States. Hablamos español, pero solo un poco y no tener ni pies ni cabeza. Saludos.
So from doing the security research and as part of your PhD, like what are the kind of seeds that end up becoming your current company, Cycuity?
So Tim Sherwood and one of his students, Mohit Tiwari at UC Santa Barbara, were kind of the founders of this whole concept of, not to go too much into the weeds, but this whole concept of information flow tracking and information flow analysis in hardware. It's really just a way of actually dynamically seeing where secrets are moving, like encryption keys and so on. I got exposed to that working with Tim and Mohit my senior year of undergraduate. And when I started grad school with Ryan at UC San Diego, you know, he thought, hey, let's just keep working in this space. So we kept working on it. We did a lot of kind of more foundational work, more theoretical type work on the technology, and ended up getting, I'd say, more practical implementations of it that seemed like this would actually, you know, work in more scalable type settings. And through that process, we actually started meeting a lot more with industry folks. Obviously, getting research funding from commercial companies is always an incentive for professors and so on. So we always had different meetings in that topic with these folks. And just through that process, we saw that there was actually a really market need for this type of technology. People were, hardware security is becoming more important. There was vulnerabilities that were being discovered that they didn't have good solutions for. This was very early on. I mean, these discussions were going on in 2012, 2013, and so on. And so Ryan and Tim, I think, always really wanted to start a company in this space, but you know, they're professors, they have full-time jobs. And so, you know, it's kind of good timing, whereas I was obviously very interested in it and I saw the need too. So myself and my co-founder, Johnny, who was Tim's student at UC Santa Barbara, and then Tim Ryan, I thought, hey, let's start this company and see if we can get a product built and see if we can get this out in the market. And before we did that, it was interesting. We, you know, going back to NSF, we actually got this small amount of funding from the National Science Foundation. It was this Innovation Cores program, which I think still exists, that basically gives you funding to do sort of market research or market validation. So they give us a small grant to Ryan, to his lab, that we could use for travel to meet with customers, really focused on customer discovery. So it's kind of like an entrepreneur's boot camp. We had weekly meetings with like this teaching team, and if you didn't meet, you know, your minimum number of meetings in that week, they would kind of like scold you. And so it was a good experience because it forced us to get out and meet with, we met with over 100 customers in I think a matter of a couple months. So a lot of meetings, really figuring out the market. And through the process, it was, you know, you're supposed to come up with a go or no go decision about whether you start the company. And at the end, we're like, yeah, it's a go. We have a framework at least of, you know, that there's a need out there. The market's, you know, big enough and it's evolving and it's growing. And we had a good sense of what our product should look like. And so we thought, you know, let's go for it. We incorporated and incorporated, I think, in 2013. Our whole goal was to get a National Science Foundation, SBIR, to fund an initial company, right? It's for us as grad students, I mean, Johnny and myself couldn't just leave and, you know, we didn't have a large bank account to fund our entrepreneurial endeavors.
Someone's got to pay for the ramen.
Exactly. You know, ramen's cheap, but it still costs money, right? So we ended up applying for National Science Foundation, SBIR, and because we went through that NSF Innovation Cores program, we had a very high probability of getting one. But we made one small mistake. We actually made one statement in our submission that we were going to use some of the funding for customer discovery, which for an SBIR, you're only allowed to fund technical work. So it was a very, you know, small thing, but they saw that and they said, it's like immediately disqualifies you basically. And so we got that feedback and we were kind of devastated. We're like, man, we were going to start this company. I was still a grad student. I was kind of waiting to say, okay, once we get this funded, then I'll finish my dissertation. I'll do my final defense and then we'll go. And you can submit these every 6 months. So we said, okay, well, we'll try one more time. If we don't get this, like, Jason and Johnny are going to go get a, you know, a normal job, I would say. But we applied again and ended up getting awarded in 2014. And so that was really like, okay, let's go start the company. So we actually, you know, I finished my dissertation, did my defense, got a little office and started cranking away. So it was very interesting how that all worked out. I mean, we were in a position where the market was way too early. The whole venture community didn't fully understand the space. So raising money you know, we had talked to VCs and so on, but it was just, it would have been challenging because it was a very early in the market. So this was kind of a really viable path. Let's get an SBIR. Let's develop some of the technology. Let's continue cranking on this. That allowed us to get out and actually just start really working, right? With opening a bank account, you know, getting a payroll system in place and just start actually, you know, operating in like a actual company.
And so that's like a 6-month burn cycle. And like, what do you have to achieve by the end of it?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's all based on what you propose in your statement of work, but we had some technical milestones we had to meet. NSS is very flexible in that it's really a grant. So it's, you know, you don't necessarily have to have a, like, here, government, here's your deliverable, because they know it's research and they want to be flexible. And, you know, startups change all the time, especially when you're that early on. So yeah, but it was only 6 months. Through that process, we got some small angel investment. And then NSF actually had a matching program where if you got some investment, the NSF would actually give you more funding to match that on a one-to-one basis. So we ended up raising a very small, some early angel investors, but the NSF was able to match that. That allowed us to kind of scoot beyond the 6 months. I think we were able to get a couple customer, very small kind of pilots. So that gave us some additional cash. Right around that time, we started pursuing a pre-seed angel type financing round. We also applied for the NSF phase two of the SBIR. So it's always, there's a phase one that's 6 months, and the phase two, I think, was 2 years. And that was for I think, $500,000. So it's a significantly, obviously, more than the original $150,000 for 6 months. So we applied for that and started raising a small angel round. Right before that, we actually joined an incubator called Evo Nexus down in San Diego. It's a really great incubator. We got a lot of support there, met a lot of really good mentors and advisors. Some joined our advisory board, some had invested in the company. And we actually leveraged that network a lot to actually get, you know, we got a lot of good help from some of these folks to raise our initial kind of small pre-seed angel kind of round. And that really coincided really well with our SBIR phase two. Both those kind of came in at the right time. And that was pretty substantial amount of money combined for us to actually start hiring more people. So we went from, you know, 3 people kind of scooting along to probably just under 10 or so. But we could actually start focusing on really building, you know, hiring a lot more engineers and start really building out our product. So that was I would say a good milestone in the evolution of the company from, like, just, you know, Jason and Johnny fiddling around in a small hot office to, you know, being in a little bit bigger space with a real team. So that was an exciting time.
Now, what's the idea and, like, the product that you're kind of incubating at this time? What did it do?
The technology within our company's kind of always been the same. It's always been kind of based on this information flow kind of techniques. We had first started focusing on this whole concept of formal verification. It sounds like a very fancy word, but basically formal verification is a way of using mathematical proofs to guarantee certain behavior. And so you can leverage this with our information flow technology to prove certain data can't leak out and so on, which obviously sounds very powerful. And that was, you know, what we heard in the market and what we thought we could demonstrate pretty effectively. The issue with some of these techniques is they don't scale to really large chips. I mean, modern semiconductor designs are enormous. They're more than a billion gates, you know, tens of billions of transistors, tons of software running on them. I mean, the scale and complexity of these devices is enormous. I'm actually amazed that they work. It's remarkable. I think it's one of the craziest things humans have ever built, ever, right? And so to get these kind of very complex mathematical proofs to work on that scale of designs was just really hard. And some of our commercial customers, they would tell us what their security issues were, which were much more bigger scale issues. And just our solution for looking at kind of using formal verification just wasn't going to work. And so we had some customers that we succeeded in, you know, selling this. We built it. We had some customers on the government side, some commercial customers kind of, I would say, more evaluating and piloting this. But we really saw this isn't going to work. So we moved to things that were more scalable, fit into the, I would say, more of the bigger scale chip design environments. The terms they use are like simulation and emulation, but basically the standard environments used to make sure the whole chip is just working correctly. The billion gates is operating as it's supposed to from a functional perspective. We've started pivoting our technology to integrate into that. That addressed some of our fundamental issues. We started doing this probably early 2017, really started identifying that and made that shift. And that was kind of right around the time we raised our initial institutional venture round as well.
And is that what became Radix?
Exactly. Yep. So this is kind of the prequel to what is now our Radix software. So yeah, Radix basically integrates into a lot of the bigger scale pre-silicon design environments. So helping identify security weaknesses by leveraging those bigger scale environments. So it can actually scale to very large chip designs, look at software issues and so on.
So who are the kind of customers using this and what are their main use cases?
We're primarily looking at, I would say, the commercial semiconductor market, so classic semiconductor companies. We have a fair amount of customers on the government side as well. There's a lot of activity within both the DoD as well as government as a whole. I mean, folks, some of your listeners may be familiar with the CHIPS Act. There's a lot of investment going into onshore manufacturing, so moving a lot of the chip foundry and manufacturing capabilities to the U.S. to help with supply chain issues. On top of all of that is a lot of different design security concerns and so on, so we're very prevalent there. In terms of use cases, there's a few. The one, and actually to talk about this, I'll give you kind of a little history. There was a big vulnerability that came out in early 2018 called Meltdown Inspector. There's a lot of variants of this, but this really exploited a lot of the low-level kind of high-performance performance features of modern processors. So the general way to think of this is that if you're running, you know, software's all sharing the same physical hardware, right? So, I mean, you open your phone and you have different apps running, and to you, it looks like everything's separated, but in reality, they're all running on the same silicon. And there's a lot of performance features in there to make sure your chip works well, and it, you know, you can run all your apps and you can play your games and all this stuff. And so, but because they all share that same physical hardware, the hardware itself can actually leak information between those different applications at a very high level. I mean, I won't go into the specifics, but Meltdown Inspector basically exploited some of those performance capabilities. And this was a huge eye opener for the industry. It caused all sorts of chaos, you know, impacted a lot of large processor vendors, you know, Intel, AMD, ARM, NVIDIA and so on, really looking at, you know, how do we address these bigger scale issues? It caused companies to reorganize, start new security initiatives. And the reason I'm mentioning this is because, one, it was a big eye-opener for the general public about the types of issues that we're addressing, but then also became a very important use case for Radix. You know, we have a set of customers really using Radix for those types of applications because they're really hard to reason about. They're complicated. You can't detect them unless you have unique technology that can help find them. So that's a very common one. And that was an important milestone in the market. I mean, it's obviously bad for society when vulnerabilities come up, but for security companies, that's always a good thing, right? So it was kind of one of those things that came up and we're like, yeah, I wasn't surprised by it, but a lot of other people were surprised by it. So that's a very important use case for us. Another one that I'd say is equally as important, is a lot more widespread, is using our software for these hardware root of trust applications. So within any modern system, and this, there's a big trend to do this, to have more embedded security. There's at the start of when you actually power on your computer, whether it's a mobile phone or a laptop or even a enterprise server rack, there's some sort of root of trust that has to say, okay, this is the right software to load. This is the software from the manufacturer. So you authenticate it, you potentially decrypt it because maybe you don't want someone to steal it. And there's a whole chain of events that happen through that boot process. Make sure that the confidentiality and integrity of the whole boot process is maintained. So the root of trust is kind of the start of that process, which is being, a lot of that's being built into hardware. And so there's a lot of use cases that products touch, both in IoT devices, huge emphasis on automotive, as well as large, I'd say more data center type applications that focus on making sure that that process isn't broken. Because if it is, then you can actually compromise and break into these systems. And that can be obviously very, very bad.
Is that kind of tied in with like the biometrics and authentication that Apple's doing as well?
Yeah, so I mean, absolutely. So a lot of the root of trust, these hardware roots of trust are used to store critical, you know, information. So I know that, for example, within the iPhone, there's a hardware enclave that stores different biometric data like your face or your fingerprint, right? And that's important because you don't want to just store that in some software array that can get, you know, easily accessed or what have you. So storing in hardware provides a lot of really strong security guarantees because you can really compartmentalize and isolate the hardware that controls that. But obviously you have to get that right at a hardware level. And one of the scary things about hardware is that a lot of times, if there's a mistake, you can't fix it. So if it's, you know, sometimes you can patch this type of stuff with low level of software updates, firmware updates, but some of these are actually baked into what's called ROM or microcode that's still software, but it's just not changeable unless like you actually physically took the device and like reprogrammed it. But, you know, for anything large scale, like an iPhone or something, you're not going to, you know, RMA every single device. It's just impractical. And so it's really important that that gets done right. Because if it's not, then the cost can be dramatic. So that's really where building the highest level assurance you can that the security of that is maintained is high importance to the industry. And that's been continuing to grow over the last several years.
And is this also tied into the idea of like signed kernels for operating systems and stuff like that?
Yep, exactly. Yep. So the root of trust is basically responsible for doing a lot of that. So basically saying the vendor will sign their, you know, low level firmware images, as well as if it's a bigger application, they're going to sign the OS. And then the whole chain of trust process, the whole secure boot process will go through and say, yep, I have the public key that can then authenticate that the signature matches. So you can say, okay, this is my authenticated boot image. And then you can kind of move through. So it's exactly that. Because obviously, if you can, you know, going back to the iPhone example or any mobile device, if someone could just run their own software on that, then you can do whatever you want. And obviously that isn't good for any of these commercial companies. They really want to make sure that only the authenticated code's running. And obviously that's important for malware too. So you want to make sure that as a consumer, you don't have malware running on your phone and that's all authenticated. So the root of trust is really responsible for all of that.
Yeah, I remember in the early Android phones, it was very easy to root them and put your own versions of the OS on there. And then it started getting progressively harder as everyone started like signing their kernels and tying back into the hardware, and the hardware would refuse to boot some little hacked OS that you had put together. So what are you up to these days at the company?
So early on in the company, I was one of the founders, obviously, and CEO for the first 6 years or so. Now one of the founders and CTO. So I've been focusing a lot more on, you know, where to take the technology in the future, what new enhancements to our products we should focus on. I'm still heavily involved in a lot of our government activities. So there's a lot of investment going into semiconductor, both manufacturing type of capabilities as well as just design security. So there's a lot of government programs that I'm still heavily involved in. As I would say, kind of a principal investigator and trying to see kind of track where things are going. So that's kind of the primary focus. I'd say the technology product direction, where some of our government focus should be. And those are sort of related because the government's trying to fund new enhancements and new capabilities and so on.
And when you're away from keyboard and actually getting back to nature and activities, what are you doing then?
Yeah, well, I wish that would happen more often than it would. You know, we're a small company, so it's always a time is always very precious and hard to find. But I do like rock climbing a lot. That's my biggest hobby lately. I grew up surfing, but it's been hard to do it. Well, I would say it's hard to do it. It's just where I live now isn't convenient. So it'd be a lot more effort than it was when I was growing up. I do like playing golf as well. But again, that's it's hard to find 4.5 hours. I'm married now too. So, you know, it's always hard to find the gaps in time to do these types of things. I make do. I'm pretty good at carving things out and getting out when I need to.
So Jason, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your experiences with the listeners of Underserved.
Andrew, thanks for having me. It's a good time. It's always fun to tell some of these old stories and talk about them again.
Absolutely. And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.